Bob, this pilot's clearly put himself in a very serious spot. And before we look at where he is and how he's going to fix this situation, don't we want to look at some risk management techniques that might have prevented this whole scenario from developing as it did?
Risk management? Well, let's talk about some of the factors here that influence the risk. A low experience level pilot, hazardous terrain around the aircraft, pilot fatigue. It's the end of the day at the end of the weekend. It's nighttime. We've got a maintenance deficient airplane. So those are just a few of the risk items here that bear upon this case.
And looking at any of them individually, you know, they may not jump out at us as being, you know, a huge problem, but, you know, it's like dropping the straws on the camel's back. How many problems are we starting out with? Because then you're getting into, okay, we're starting with this. What's going to happen as we go down the road? And here we have, you know, this guy's going along fat, dumb, and happy. And then all of a sudden, boy, this situation gets real serious in a real hurry.
Well, we pyramid the whole thing with a weather issue at the end. So that further complicates things and increases the risk.
Wally, here you are. You know, you're flying along comfortably en route home on a Sunday night. And then all of a sudden, you're in the clouds and you can't see a thing. What is your very first action?
Well, the natural reaction is to say, I better get out of here quickly because I'm not supposed to be here. And that's absolutely 100% the wrong reaction, of course.
So what do we do? John?
Take a deep breath.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of our discussions and roundtables and stuff, we say that, you know, you need to do quick action. Sometimes quick action is required, but in here, 30 seconds or a minute or so, you've got at least that. Get the airplane stabilized. Make sure it's trimmed. If you've got an autopilot, you might want to consider flipping that on and at least something that's going to hold the wings level. And then decide what you're going to do for your next action. And here we're looking at our next action is going to be climb. But you were looking outside, looking at the ground lights going by, looking at the road and everything. Now all of a sudden you have to transition to instruments, change the configuration of the airplane, establish a climb. So take a deep breath first.
And you are clearly going to panic and the adrenaline's going to start running right now. But the fact of the matter is the airplane doesn't know it's in the clouds.
Right.
You are an instrument trained pilot. You have the qualifications to deal with this situation. So it's not as bad as it looks, but the panic and the need to try to fix it, just kind of a human attribute, can clearly get in the way.
It's going to make it bad.
Exactly. So, Tom, when you're dealing with a student, how do you prepare the student for the situation? And what are your top three recommendations?
Well, first, I try to make a distinction between an abnormality and emergency procedure. We don't make that distinction very much in civilian pilot training, but most of what we would consider to be an emergency is really just an abnormal situation. It could develop very rapidly into an emergency, but there is time, as we said, to take a breath. Our first response is in what we tend to train pilots to do if you have an inadvertent encounter with IMC, is to make a 180-degree turn, to make a level turn out of there. But in this particular instance, we have some significant obstacles on both sides of the aircraft. We're flying down a narrow valley. And if you were to make, for instance, flying along at 90 to 100 knots ground speed, if you were to make a standard rate level turn, you would end up about 3/4 of a mile one side or the other of your ground track by the time you've completed that turn. So one of the things that I try to stress to pilots is there is the emergency response and then there is the abnormal procedures response. In this particular case, it's really much more of immediately it's an abnormal procedure. Fly straight ahead and before you make a turn, evaluate whether or not you'll be able to do that in the narrow confines of this valley.
And Bob, how serious is vertigo disorientation with the loss of visual reference at night?
Very serious. This pilot is going to be startled when this occurs. That's going to distract him to some degree. And if he starts a turn immediately, who knows what kind of angle of bank he's going to develop and what the nose is going to do. Overbanking, nose goes down. Not to mention, if he chooses to make that turn, he would not have had time to consider which way to turn based on the wind and the terrain. Disorientation is going to be the result of it.
And, you know, another thing this poor pilot had working against him, which, by golly, many, many a pilot has working against him, is the lack of solid instrument training experience in the weather. Mm-hmm. We can be instrument qualified and capable, but clearly this guy has not spent a lot of time in the weather. Wally, what's the difference between actual and simulated instruments?
Big difference, I think, Bob. Big difference. You know that there's no more peaking.
Bingo.
I'd like to go back to what Tom said. I think that's true. You know, most of our training involving inadvertent IMC encounters says do a 180, except in this case, that's not the best solution. So, again, if this pilot had thought through this night flight with some clouds in a valley, part of his pre-flight preparation should have been inadvertent IMC. Am I really going to do what I normally do? And because he is an instrument pilot, perhaps it's more likely he'll climb, but I'm guessing the likelihood is he's going to try a steep turn and get out of there.
Bob, when you were looking at the risk management issues, we talked about fatigue. And I'll tell you, when I look at aircraft accidents year in and year out, pilots do something seriously wrong. I think often that can be attributed to fatigue. And when did this event occur? This event occurred somewhere after 8 o'clock because it's dark on a summer night. This guy's within an hour or two of normal bedtime dealing with a very, very serious emergency. Is fatigue going to be our friend or?
Fatigue is going to be our enemy. And fatigue is one of the risk factors here that were within his control. Also, making the flight at night was within his control. Beyond that, the maintenance issue here with this airplane was within his control. So there's three risk issues here that could have been handled easily by the pilot and eliminated.
He could have mitigated.
Could have left earlier.
He could have mitigated almost all of those risks.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And there's also a little bit of a history here. We said in the beginning that he's been doing this for a while, but he scared himself a couple of times, so he decided to then go get an instrument rating. So how many times has he actually done this? Caused him to go out and seek the training and get it. But now he's removed that from his bag of tools.
He's not using it, though.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So are we a serial offender here? Or?
Well, there's a couple things that come into play, too, with complacency. He does this every Sunday night. So this is just another mm-hmm. routine flight home. And up until the point where he goes into the clouds, that's exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. So we talk about how important it is in flying to be several moves ahead of your airplane. Well, at best, he's up with his airplane, and now he's chasing that airplane. A real serious situational awareness challenge that has occurred here, and it's occurred at night in the weather. Is night flying more dangerous than daytime?
Certainly is, in my opinion.
It is, yeah. Because necessarily it is, because we are deprived of valuable feedback. I mean, we respond. So much of what we do in flying is a response to visual stimulus. Remove so much of that visual stimulus at night, and in this case here, you've removed all of the visual stimulus, mm-hmm. and all you have is you and your cockpit. And so, you know, if indeed you're well-trained, well-qualified, calmly say, okay, I'm in the cloud, you look at your instruments, you know, you're straight and level, what am I going to do here? I know that there's not a mountain out in front of me. I'm going to casually climb to get out of this altitude that I'm at, and then I'm going to turn. Yeah, if you're composed to do that, but how do you get to that level of composure? Training, training, training. How many general aviation pilots are trained to that standard, Wally?
Well, our scenario pilot, we recognized had done very little actual instrument flying and had done very little instrument flying, so it's pretty obvious that he wasn't doing any training.
So his proficiency level was minimal.
Right. And the actual instrument that you get training is often very different than the actual instrument you get. You know, actual instrument during training might be going out with the instructor and doing a couple ILS approaches with a 1,000, 2,000 foot ceiling or something like that, not being at 4,500 feet at night over the mountains, suddenly transitioning to instrument reference and instrument navigation. Talking about there is more of a recovery rather than a planned flight.
Well, that's true. And a lot of the issue that we talk about, looking at the other end of it, making the transition from instrument to visual flight is a recognized serious risk. When you're flying approaches down to minimum, it takes time to learn how to properly make the transition from IFR to VFR. We're going the other way without any warning. At least coming down an ILS approach, we know where the lights should be. And in this case, we're making that at least that significant of a change.
Going the other way
with no warning and, as you said, no outside reference whatsoever.
And no anticipation of it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Bob, in your instructor comments, you talked about a pop-up ATC or IFR clearance. And a lot of pilots keep that in reserve. Well, I'll just get a pop-up clearance. Not that simple, nor easy.
Very difficult to do, starting with what frequency will you come up on? Mm-hmm. And where are you going to get that frequency?
And how much of a distraction is it going to be when you're panicked? I mean, next thing you know, start talking about vertigo disorientation, you start reaching into a bag or looking down for a
frequency. Trying to get a chart.
Yes. You know, that's all head movement, and that's going to get that inner ear totally discombobulated and contribute to your vertigo
disorientation. Moving that head is just going to induce or increase the likelihood of inducing vertigo.
And ATC, I mean, they're not sitting there waiting to give out your IFR clearance.
There is a protocol there.
There is a protocol, and it's not going to happen with the snap of a fingers. They have to go through a sequence of questions, and it's just going to further distract you and disorient you and frustrate you. And so ATC really can't help you much.
They're not really an option in this particular case. The environment is not such that there's good coverage. Mm-hmm. You don't have the frequency available. You're flying VFR.
Let's say, for instance, that you were able to contact ATC in this situation. And let's say also, for instance, that the transponder was working properly and the scenario was different. You were flying VFR and you wanted to transition to IFR. If you were at 4,500 feet and you're between the mountains here, you're probably not under radar coverage right now. So if you did get that clearance, what's the clearance going to be? What are they going to tell you to do? Probably. Climb straight ahead to some fix, to some altitude. So that's the fix here. That's the repair for the situation. IFR or VFR, you need to climb straight ahead, aiming at something. But
and they're going to tell you, maintain VFR.
Well, yeah, sure. There's that, too.
You're responsible for your own terrain clearance.
And they're going to ask you, if you can't maintain VFR, can you provide your own terrain clearance until reaching 6,000 feet?
Which assumes, again, visual contact.
And, or at least a real good idea of knowing where you are, that you can climb on a radial or something to that effect.
Good point. Knowing where you are. I see a lot of people that fly. Now, in this situation, he's using the highway.
Is
your magenta line, all right? Yeah. It's a bunch of headlights. I see a lot of my students, they fall into a trap I call magenta line thinking. They know on their GPS they're going from here to there, but they really don't have much concept of what happens in between. And your point is know where you are.
Right.
Whether you're flying with electronic guidance or visually down a highway, just having a concept of what's around you at any one point is extremely important.
Right. And do you keep that VOR, if you're using VOR or GPS, whatever you're using, do you keep updating, do you keep centering the needle, keep hitting the direct to and getting a fresh course at least to the nearest fix?
And not only what's ahead of you, but what's to either side, which is very important in this particular case.
My guess, our pilot did not have an IFR low altitude chart on his lap, keeping track of where he was. So can you imagine the confusion? Trying to find your low altitude chart, unfold it to the right place. This is in the dark now, and locating the fix that they've just told you to climb to.
Or your airplane's going to be upside down before you know it. I mean, you start looking in your bag for those charts.
Even if it's as simple as trying to find it on an iPad that's already on a clip on your yoke, there's still a lot of
button pushing,
and disorientation.
Very distracting at a critical time.
Mm-hmm. How helpful might it be for this pilot? And we talk about first actions. To engage the autopilot, if you have one, with regard to really mitigating some of the potential disaster that lies ahead?
Most helpful.
Yep, if you've got one. But again, make sure that
it's not going to do some strange things.
So if
the heading bug is centered. And
Right. Mm-hmm. And if you have a roll trim on it or something, you don't want to turn it on and have it roll you into a bank.
We pilots worry a lot about legal stuff. So, okay, this has happened. And yes, it indeed will lead to an FAA FISDO, Flight Standards District Office follow-up. You talk about the NASA report. Let's spend a few moments on that just to kind of help, you know, because these are factors that get in pilots' mind and they might get in the way of you doing the right thing to get out of this situation. Bob?
Well, the fact that it's going to wind up with the FISDO doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be a negative outcome. However, in this case, there most likely would be because of the expiration of the 91-411 and 413 checks on the static system and the transponder. But the FISDO is going to investigate the circumstances and your actions and evaluate the competency of the pilot at the conclusion of their review.
But, you know, once again, and if enforcement action is taken, do you not do the right thing to avoid having that on your record? I mean, and many a pilot has has not reported it because they didn't want to get in trouble. Well, there's getting in trouble and there's dying.
Yeah. Yes, there is. And it's preferable to get in trouble in this case.
But there's also – people are afraid of this. You look at it, this guy really does deserve to be violated. Yeah. I mean, there's not many times I would actually say that. We all try to stick up for the pilot group, but maybe this guy needs to lose his license for 30 days and get some remedial training because – you just clearly chipped away at the edge here, and the successful outcome was the fact that you were able to meet with the FISDO inspector instead of them coming to the accident site.
And Wally, we talked about filing of a NASA report. Do you think most pilots understand that system and realize what a tool it is for pilots to actually help the system out here and report the data so that it can be used in a safety manner?
It does, Bob. I think in my experience is that a lot of pilots are not familiar with it, but it is a great system. If you file the NASA Aviation Safety Reporting form, it indicates to the FAA that you have a positive safety attitude, which is going to help you when you talk to the FAA, number one. Number two, it puts your experience in a data bank, which will help other people analyze the causes of accidents and incidents in our system and will help prevent them. So it's a good move. And number three, if the FAA should propose some certificate suspension, it is held off by the fact that you filed that report, as long as your activity wasn't criminal activity, I think, or something.
Or intentional.
And you only can do this one time in, what, five years?
You can file as many as you want.
You can file as many as you want. You can only get out of penalty.
Get out of jail free card.
Yeah, one time.
Well, most people think of it simply as a get out of jail free card. I like to think of it simply as it shows the FAA that you have a positive safety attitude, and I think that's going to go a lot farther for you when you talk to them than anything else.
The penalty benefit is the carrot that is held out for us. The objective of the system is to get as much safety-related data in under analysis as possible. And in order to encourage pilots to submit these – and controllers and other professionals to submit these reports, we have that benefit of avoiding the results of suspensions and fines and such.
But that report must be filed within 10 days.
Correct. Right. True.
And it can be filed in hard copy.
Electronically.
Electronically.
You can do it online.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's all de-identified. So.
Yeah.
I think that by way of summing up, this is clearly one of those situations where prior planning prevents the poor performance. There were a lot of little things that should have been very, very obvious to this pilot, but things that we do routinely or casually often miss this vital, vital step of looking at what you're doing it, when you're doing it, and why you're doing it, and mitigating or dealing with, consciously having a plan to mitigate any risk that you're taking.
And decision-making at the beginning of the whole situation. Right. What kind of decisions are being made? Aeronautical decision-making 101.
Exactly. And, it's so ironic that so many times we have these nighttime mishaps that if just transferring that flight to the next morning, getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning, going out to the airport, the weather is clear, crisp, you're fresh, you're ready to go, it's an hour flight, you get home in time to go to work. You've accomplished your total objective in an entire different framework than you did the night before.
Which minimizes the risk factors that we've enumerated.
Mm-hmm. So there are good solutions to all the challenges. We don't want to just throw challenges at everybody, but there are indeed valid ways to mitigate the risk if we take the time to look at them.